Welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I'm Eric Umansky, an editor here at ProPublica, and I'm very happy to be here with Amanda Taub, who is now at the New York Times. Is the column called The Interpreter?
It is, yes.
It is indeed called The Interpreter. And previously was at Vox writing about foreign affairs. But the thing we actually have her here to speak about is really, in a sense, neither of those things. It is a story that you wrote all the way back in the spring that I think is one of the most prescient pieces of the year, called The Rise of American Authoritarianism, about how academic research showing how sort of signals showing support for authoritarianism rising in the U.S. and looking at it as a kind of field of study. But before you get into any of those details, tell me, well, first of all, I should say, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
You're at Vox. You're writing about South Africa. You're writing about Argentina. And then suddenly you have this very long detailed piece at a fairly obscure field of study involving the United States and other countries, but you're focusing on the United States. So what happened for you? I mean, how did you end up there?
Yeah, so I had made it a little bit of a project to try to figure out what explained Donald Trump's success in the primaries, starting pretty early on. You know, this was a story that I think probably every journalist in America was on some level trying to figure out. And I had very understanding editors at Vox who let me do that, even though it was not really technically my beat. So I'd been interviewing professors, I'd been reading political theory, trying to sort of find if there was research that might explain what was going on. And I had talked to a few, and sort of, you know, bits and pieces here and there seemed really helpful, but nothing really seemed like an explanation for what had changed, you know, what was new in the country that Trump was succeeding now, whereas, you know, we hadn't had politicians like him succeed in previous elections, really. And one morning I was up, you know, very early, I think it was 3 a.m., I was feeding my infant daughter and scrolling through political theories on my iPhone, reading blogs as you do, and I came across a reference to a theory called authoritarianism, and then specifically some work that had been done by a political scientist named Karen Stenner. And her argument was that authoritarianism was essentially a worldview, that it was a set of kind of beliefs, preferences, and tendencies that a lot of people had, and that they didn't necessarily become politically important until they were activated by something, until there was some set of circumstances that essentially made authoritarians feel frightened or worried or stressed out enough that they would seek out authoritarian leaders. So I read about this, you know, sitting there, glow of the iPhone, 3 a.m., trying to stay awake. And I thought it really seemed like there might be something to this. So I decided to do some more reading. I looked into it. Karen Stenner herself had actually left academia and moved to Australia, so I wasn't able to interview her. But it turned out that there were some other political scientists who'd done a lot of work on this, and I spoke to them. And the more I learned about this, the more it really seemed to explain what was going on with Trump's support.
So unfurl that a little bit, because, you know, your initial question is, what's changed, right?
Right. So it turns out that two big things have changed. So the first one has been going on for several decades, which is that the people who have these authoritarian tendencies, there's a test for authoritarianism, which I'll get to in just a minute, and people who score highly on it have been filtering into the Republican Party for decades. And some researchers named Mark Hetherington and Jonathan Weiler have looked at this, and they believe that it's actually been a major driver of polarization in politics generally in the United States, that because authoritarians tend to be uncomfortable with social change, and the Republican Party, since the Civil Rights era, has positioned itself as kind of being against social change, almost as a side effect of its positions on civil rights and women's rights, gay rights, et cetera, authoritarians have been filtering into the Republican Party, so are now a quite large and powerful constituency within the Republican electorate. So that's the first thing that changed. And then the second thing that changed is that in the last few years in this country, we've been seeing a number of quite rapid social changes that researchers believe are the kind of thing that would activate authoritarians, or the way others put it, they make authoritarianism salient to political beliefs. So those include not just increased immigration, but increased immigrant communities around the country. So for the last couple of decades, immigrant communities in the United States have been spreading out throughout the country. So effectively, there have been immigrant booms in places like Arkansas, even though overall in the country, the levels haven't necessarily changed that much. We had a black president. We have had, you know, a number of other changes, including the way that the country's economy is changing. We're shifting away from industry and agriculture and towards more of a kind of services and knowledge-based economy. The country is becoming more urban. So any one of these things wouldn't necessarily have that much of an effect on its own, but together they mean that the country is going through really profound shifts. And they are shifts that have had particular impact on the less educated white voters. And so what researchers like Hetherington believe is that those voters, you know, the authoritarians among them are particularly likely to seek out authoritarian leaders right now, because this is a set of circumstances that is particularly likely to have put them under stress and particularly likely to kind of make their authoritarian tendencies get active.
Right. So back to the story. You are doing some very impressive 3 a.m. work while feeding a baby, which, by the way, I have children. When I was up in the middle of the night, I was watching Law and Order, you know.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I also watched a lot of TV, but it turned out to be a good time to get some reading done as well. So I started talking to these researchers, and one thing that jumped out at me is that this is kind of a testable hypothesis. There is a test for authoritarianism. You ask people four questions about their parenting preferences, and they're questions like, which is more important for a child to be obedient or self-reliant? And they sound pretty neutral. You know, obedience and self-reliance, I think most people would say, are both good things. So it's not necessarily, you know, it doesn't feel like a trick or a trap or anything like that to ask people these questions. But really, they're designed to figure out how important it is to people that there is sort of a hierarchy of authority and people following rules and doing what they're supposed to do. And you can see how that would be, you know, something that would show up in parenting preferences. I realized that because there are these four questions that give you a score for authoritarianism, we could actually test this with polling to see if it actually did explain anything about support for Trump or not. So Vox at the time had an agreement with a polling and media company named Morning Consult that they did big polls every week, mostly focused on political questions, and had agreed that Vox could submit questions to go into the field in their polls. And so luckily, one of the people who runs Morning Consult is a political scientist named Kyle Dropp. So when I got in touch with him, he immediately understood what I was trying to do here and helped me put together some questions, you know, the four parenting questions and then some other things to test. You know, basically, we wanted to know three things, right? Like, we wanted to know whether people's authoritarianism scores correlated with their political views. We wanted to know what other kind of political preferences in terms of policies they correlated with. And we also wanted to know what might be activating them. We wanted to find out if there were things that authoritarians were particularly worried about, particularly frightened about.
Okay, so what'd you find?
So we found that, I guess the results were very interesting. So first of all, authoritarianism did turn out to be very predictive of votes for Donald Trump. And so it did seem like that was something, you know, it certainly wasn't the only thing going on, but it was the most predictive factor, I believe, other than education levels. I would have to go back and check the data. But it was very strong. And then the second thing that we found was that people who scored highly in authoritarianism also were very likely to support a range of quite harsh policy preferences. on things like they wanted a much more aggressive foreign policy. They wanted to kind of limit civil liberties in the interests of protecting public safety, do things like, you know, have people be required to carry an ID card and be required to produce it on request, additional security checks of people of Middle Eastern descent, things like that. And then when we asked questions about people's sense of threat, the responses were pretty interesting. You know, there were some questions that we asked that there was really no difference between authoritarians and non-authoritarians in how threatened they felt by things like car accidents, for instance. So the thing that I found really interesting was that we put together a little index of kind of groups of threats, and there was one that focused on threats from foreigners, so the governments of Russia and Iran and foreign terrorist organizations. And authoritarians were dramatically more concerned about those threats than other kinds and more concerned than non-authoritarians were. And they were likewise more concerned about social changes that had to do with foreigners and unfamiliar groups. So things like Muslims building mosques in American cities was a real concern for them. Illegal immigration was more of a concern for them, whereas non-authoritarians tended to not be as worried about that.
And what was your understanding of that?
I think a big part of this, and what the research suggests, is that if you have that worldview, you are particularly uncomfortable with people who are different, with outsiders, with what researchers often call outgroups. So a sense that there's this sort of group that's different from you and they're unfamiliar, authoritarians are much more likely to find that threatening. And I think that that is something that is really a key thing to understand about what a lot of the things we've seen during this election. So particularly Trump's focus on immigrants, you know, his early comments implying that Mexican immigrants are, well, stating that Mexican immigrants are rapists, and his, you know, promise to ban or limit Muslim immigration, his promise to build the wall. All of these things are about kind of saying that outgroups are dangerous and promising to offer protection against them. And that is, I think, an idea that really appeals to authoritarians. And it, I think, becomes especially important to them once they're in this kind of activated state, once their authoritarianism becomes salient to politics.
Right. Okay, so now, I don't know how many nights you're up at 3 a.m., but I think we're at the point now where you're writing your article, right?
Right. So I gathered the data with Morning Consult. That came back. Then I was writing the article. My process for this was a little unusual in that I was basically collaborating with some academics throughout the process. So in particular, Mark Hetherington, who's at Vanderbilt, and Stanley Feldman, who is the researcher at a college in New York, who he actually came up with the four-question test. So I was really lucky to have their kind of input throughout this on what questions to use. But also, they looked at the data when it came back, and they helped me with the analysis for it and sent me what they thought their findings, you know, what the data suggested. So that was the next step, actually, before writing, was to kind of basically go back and do a second round of interviews around this data and around the analysis that these academics had done. To find out about their findings. After that, it was time to write.
You end up writing an article that doesn't simply explain the rise of Trump, but that says there's just part of a larger trend. The article is The Rise of American Authoritarianism, and it says this may be the beginning of many Trumps. Was that a conscious choice on your part?
It was, I would say, not so much a conscious choice as something that came out of the reporting, which was this is not something that is specific to one particular politician. You know, Trump is, I think, particularly capable of appealing to this kind of authoritarian preference, but it certainly isn't limited to him. What the research and the data revealed is that this was a phenomenon that went way beyond Trump. You know, this wasn't an effect of just one politician, you know, one celebrity or something like that. There was a real demand for this from a large chunk of the American voting public. And so what that suggested to me was that there was a possibility that this could go beyond Trump, that there would be an opening for other politicians like him to embrace that style of politics. And I definitely still believe that, particularly because, you know, one of the things that tends to keep politics on a kind of fairly even keel and, you know, makes really unusual events unusual is institutions. And, you know, for politics, one of the most important ones are political parties. And right now, political parties in the United States are quite weak. You know, this is partly due to the way campaign finance works. There's more and more money that circumvents the parties. It's also because of some of these kind of broader shifts and resortings in American society. I think the parties are trying to figure out how to reorient themselves to deal with that, and they haven't done it yet. But I think the result of that is, you know, once again, there's going to be demand for this kind of politics. Trump has kind of shown people what the path to success looks like, and there will be relatively few obstacles to it because of these institutional weaknesses.
The basic point there is that what you think of as stable democracies and what academics have long thought, which is that, you know, once an industrialized country becomes a democracy, it sort of locks in that way. Now there's some research emerging and some pretty strong evidence in various countries that that's not necessarily the case. Just talk about that briefly and how you came across that and what you think the import of it is.
Yeah, so to start with the last question, how I came across it, after the election, I was lucky enough to just spend some time reporting. And for me, the reporting I do, the sources I talk to, are usually academic researchers or other analysts. You know, I'm not somebody who's out there gathering facts on the street or sifting through documents for the most part. Like, I really focus on research. So I called researchers and just did a bunch of interviews, talked to a lot of them, and that eventually brought me to this guy named Yasha Monk, who is a lecturer at Harvard and researches democracies, and in particular, the stability of liberal democracy. So he and his colleague, Stefan Foa, had put together a test for measuring democratic stability, and it really focuses on how much the public is willing to support democracy, you know, how important they think it is for their country to be democratic, how willing to consider other forms of government, like military rule they are, et cetera. So they put together this measure and looked at data from countries around the world. And what they noticed was that Western democracies, particularly sort of Anglo-English democracies, so in the United States, Australia, as well as a lot of Western Europe, support for democracy was falling. And so then they wondered, well, do we have a real result on our hands? Is this just a kind of statistical quirk, something weird going on in the data, or could it actually predict something? And so they looked at other countries in the past that had had those kind of scores, and they found that in a number of cases, it really did seem to predict that what we call democratic deconsolidation. So countries that had been quite democratic and had, you know, fairly strong rule of law and personal freedom scores, and then sort of gone back in the other direction. So become more autocratic, less free, had things like press crackdowns. One of the case studies they looked at was Venezuela, which for a long time looked like it was on its way to being a very consolidated democracy. But now, obviously, after many years of populist rule, is in very bad shape. You know, it's one of the most violent countries in the world in terms of crime levels. The economy is in very bad shape. There's massive discontent politically and socially, and it's, you know, not a democracy anymore in many of the ways that we think of as important. You know, they still hold elections.
The final question I have, it's a big one, but I think an important one, is given all this stuff that you have spent the past nearly year studying and your understanding of the bigger picture, what do you think the implications are or should be for how we cover the Trump administration?
The big thing that I keep coming back to is this is new in American politics and it is new in this era, but it is not new in the world. One of the reasons why I call so many academics is this has happened in other parts of the world, and this has happened in parts of history. And so there's a lot of knowledge out there. And so I think that one of the most important things for us to do is to draw on the existing knowledge about what is important in political moments like this, what causes this kind of political behavior, where it can go, and really make use of that and bring it to the public's attention. So, you know, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to publish a piece about Monk and Foa's research was I think that it's important to realize that democracies need to be sort of taken care of in order to survive. We can't just assume that it's some sort of law of physics that once a country is democratic, it will stay that way. It's a matter of preserving institutions and preserving checks and balances and the integrity of the various players. And so I think, you know, it's not just about holding powerful people to account. That's always important. But it's also about sort of making clear to people the stakes of this. And, you know, I think that's not just about the current administration, because one of the things that I think this research has made very clear to me is that this is not just a story about politicians. This is a story about the country and what is going on with the public and voters that we need to pay attention to.
That's great. Thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the ProPublica podcast.